Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We thought we were done with draft shows, but I couldn't resist this one. Justin Mello, our friend from SI, is here to tell us why he graded the Ravens draft second overall among all 32 NFL drafts. Justin, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Ken. Appreciate you for having me on and talk a little about this Baltimore Ravens draft class that I came away very, very impressed with.
Yeah, well, it's good to talk methodology at the high level because there are a lot of entities out there willing to instantly grade a draft. I kind of understand the hook there, that there's the need to like put something out that people will be interested in and look at and but yeah, that's a B plus for the Ravens or that's an A minus for the Ravens. But there seem to be two things about them though. One is they have a very narrow range of grades. Nobody can get like below a C, or if there is, there's one team that gets an F, but nobody else gets below a C. And the other thing is I never really get very satisfied with the methodology used for that. So I want to talk to you up front a little bit about that. And I know it's you and your colleagues at SI that put this together.
It was actually just me, which is why it took quite a long time to put together. And I think you hit the nail on the head, and I'll be totally honest with you. I didn't put it out, you know, the Monday after the draft. I would have done phenomenal numbers if I did, but I certainly feel, as I think you somewhat alluded to, you're probably selling the process a little short, you know, when you get it out that quickly. So instead, I took, you know, we're several weeks removed from the draft now. I only put out the piece earlier this week, really, you know, trying to be thorough in my process, going through all 32 draft classes, revisiting the grades. Because of course I watch and study these prospects leading up to the pre-draft. I spoke to about 150 of them, you know, through my interview series. So getting to know some of them, my film grades, you know, combine, athleticism, character concerns or questions based on conversations I've had, trying to take all that into account while being a bit more thorough than the microwavable versions that probably come out on the Monday or Tuesday.
That's a really good point. There are a lot that come out very soon and you wonder how can they really know this, but there's a lot of limitations in terms of understanding value in the draft. And the biggest one of all is differences in draft capital, whether that means the number of picks, or the difference in the value and expected player you'll get from a certain pick. The Ravens never draft particularly high, and I think any rigorous look at drafting over the last 30 years has three clear standout teams if you're looking at value relative to draft capital, and those are the Packers, the Steelers, and the Ravens. And it's a wide gap down to the next tier of teams that have done it. But I kind of, you know, wonder, when you're grading the draft, how do you adjudicate between a team that had 11 picks and a lot of draft capital and a team that had, you know, maybe like Seattle, who had only four selections and not a ton of draft capital drafting 32nd?
Well, in all honesty, it's, you know, boo-hoo a little bit, right? Like if you only had four picks, and Seattle, I know they went in with four. They actually ended up making eight because John Schneider probably realized how many, you know, four is not enough, and he traded down a couple times. But if you don't have a lot of picks, the unfortunate reality is you're probably not going to put together a great draft class, right? It's just, I had the Los Angeles Rams, who made five picks only. I had them ranked 31st in this exercise out of 32. The amount of picks they had contributed, but to be clear, it wasn't the only reason, right? They also, you know, drafted a quarterback at number 13.
Ty Simpson.
Yeah, that kind of made all of us, you know, brought our jaws to the floor a little bit. So I don't think many out there will probably try to force some sort of methodology that maybe doesn't ding a team for having few picks. To that, I say boo-hoo. You probably can't have a phenomenal draft class. If you have four picks and they're all Pro Bowlers, sure, you know, you can make it work, but chances are, the more picks you have, the better value, but that's not all that goes into it.
You know, I kind of like it in this sense that there has to be some, calling on the carpet for the front offices that are willing to trade away their draft picks. And fan bases always want you to trade draft picks away for players. They always want you to, you know, the Crosby trade in Baltimore, overwhelmingly popular because it was acquiring a star talent, despite the fact that it gave up two first-round draft picks. I hated it. I mean, I really hated it, and I'm glad that they you know, reversed it and ended up having what I think is clearly going to be a better outcome for the Ravens from getting Ioane and then a pick in 27 as well. But I wanted I agree with your limited pitch. This is the time to recognize it. This is the time to say, hey, you screwed up and you trade your picks. That's why you had a crappy draft.
I mean, I really do think it can be that simple. Now, admittedly, and I think this is the right way to go about it, that's not, I didn't automatically ding teams for having Logan. In fact, the team that got my 32nd, the worst grade, I think won't surprise many, I gave to the Jacksonville Jaguars, who I believe made 8 picks. Now, yes, it's important to have picks, but it's more important what you do with those picks, right? Right. Like Jacksonville had terrific capital, but they didn't exactly come away with, you know, players, in my opinion, that I thought made up a great draft. I mean, I remember, you'll remember the Cleveland Browns, a division rival, having 2 first round picks. I mean, in theory, that's phenomenal. But when you take Justin Gilbert and Johnny Manziel, you don't exactly look back on that class and say it was a home run. So certainly the more darts you have, the better chance that you're going to finish with a high score. But sometimes it's the team that, you know, hit the bullseye with what they've got that comes out on top.
Darts. Here are my 3 things that I really dislike in order of magnitude in terms of describing draft picks as somehow a lucky chances or lottery draws or whatever. Lottery tickets is the worst because it undersells the value of the individual GM talent and whatnot. I don't buy it at all. Darts are slightly better, but you know, darts people associate with monkeys throwing darts to pick stocks and that sort of thing, which is a classic experiment that's been done multiple times. And I don't think that captures the skill element. What I like is World Series of Poker entries. That's what I think draft picks are. You know, yes, you have to have some luck to go with that. You have to have some good fortune, but it also takes skill. And, you know, I could play in the World Series of Poker and I'd have 1/16 the chance to win it all that Phil Ivey has, or at least it's been described that way in some books that have done the topic. That's kind of where I feel about it. And so whenever I talk to draft people who analyze the draft, Eric DaCosta is perfectly happy to lean right into the lottery ticket narrative. And the large portion is because he wants to generally acquire lower round draft picks. It's a very positive thing. If you do, the last thing you want to do is say, look, I'm going to be better with those picks, so I want as many of them as I can have. No, just go with the lottery tickets. Go with the lottery tickets and other people will trade your picks.
I love that way you describe that because I don't know about you, but I've never won the lottery, right? So I totally get the perspective. And you're right. Like the books may say that you have 1/16th chance that Phil Ivey has. Yeah. If I'm a gambling man, I'm probably putting my money on Phil Ivey and saying he's got a better shot, right? So certainly, I mean, and I appreciate Eric DaCosta's affinity for acquiring those late round picks. I also think time and place, right? Like, I think you can take a couple of chances maybe with those day 3 picks. And I think the Ravens did that in this draft class, but it's walking a tightrope a little bit, isn't it? Like you look at maybe the final pick they made versus the first pick they made. And, one of them might be a lottery ticket, whereas that first one is, it's probably as safe and reliable as it gets.
It certainly is a high value pick they need to hit on, but let's go through a little bit of the draft and tell us, maybe pick by pick what you thought of them. So Venga Ioane at the top of the draft, fills a big need for the Ravens. I thought the pick was important for a couple of reasons, but tell me your theory first and then I'll chime in.
Well, plug and play, right? I mean, I just think one of the better football players in this class and a really straightforward, easy evaluation in all honesty. I mean, when you watch him on tape, he moves defenders from point A to point B against their will. He generates a lot of power and he creates movement. And when I project him, I know there's a new coordinator there, but I reckon, one who's inheriting Lamar Jackson and Derrick Henry, I imagine the run game is still going to be fairly important in Baltimore this coming season. And when you can get a guard who just creates movement and kind of creates these rushing lanes the way that he does, plug and play, not one you miss on a whole lot. Like, I hate to make this comparison, but I cover the Tennessee Titans a little bit, and they were up in arms, the fan base was, when they drafted Peter Skoronski a couple of years ago in a similar range to this pick here. Well, fast forward to today, he's like the only first-round pick they've made who they're happy to extend his contract and pay him $20, $25 million a year. When you get these surefire players, like I believe Ioane to be, I think you kind of make that pick. And one thing an executive once told me that I can sort of relate to this choice, not specifically about this pick, but another pick in a previous year. I made that pick and I went to bed and I got 8 hours of sleep. I imagine
that's good.
I imagine he slept very, very well after making that pick. Not a worry in the world.
Yeah, the Ravens traded away their first round pick. I think it was in 2010. They had the 24th overall pick or 25 might have been. And they traded back to like 47 or something. And they said, you know, everybody left the building and there was a lot of anxiety over the next day over that thing. So just the opposite. But you want a terrific pass blocker. Is what he brings to the table is from my perspective. But the other thing that I think really was good about this pick, the first of two things I'll mention anyway, is that he set up the rest of the Ravens draft because they needed really two offensive linemen. They got one taken care of right away, and that meant that they could hunt for value in the big game way the Ravens do typically throughout the rest of the draft. And they didn't end up getting their center, which was really kind of bothered a lot of people. But they did, I think, get value with some other selections, which we'll go through. Very interesting top of the first round at pick number 11. Ravens fans on my stream extremely nervous about who they would get. And then three picks in a row, Dallas trading up to get Caleb Downs. The pick of Caleb Proctor, of all people, at number 12 by Miami was just that was kind of a strange one, too. Could have traded the pick and gotten Proctor six picks later, probably, I would think. And then the pick of Simpson. Not only is the Simpson pick a strange one, that pick had real value because apparently there were other teams trying to jump ahead of the Ravens and get Yawane, Bain, or Sadiq, who were the three guys the Ravens were considered at number 14. But, you know, it's just a really strange pick and a great set of circumstances. But sometimes on draft night, the weirdest things happen and you are so thankful for the way things play out.
And for the Ravens specifically, by the way, they got to be thanking the Dolphins a little bit. Like, I don't know if you've seen this. They're playing Proctor at guard this year.
Yep.
So I said to myself,
why not?
You want a guard who already is a guard, who's a really good guard. Now, to justify it a little bit from the conversations I've had, I believe the plan is to kick Proctor out to right tackle a year from now. That's probably what made the difference for them. And of course, you know, it's a more valuable position at tackle, but I still can't help but wonder if maybe they galaxy-brained this thing a little bit. But I don't think the Ravens mind one bit.
No, not at all. And if the Ravens had some lousy guard play last year with Voorhees and Fa'alele not really doing particularly well. But the team I always pointed to was, if you really want the worst guards in the league, go to the Miami Dolphins. They're worse than the Ravens by a wide margin. And the Dolphins, you know, with their needed guard being similar, I would have thought that's a place to foundationally rebuild their team, which is obviously in transition, I think we'll say fairly right now.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, they've torn it down to the studs. And I thought they'd go with an offensive lineman there, but I was stunned when we found out that it was Proctor.
All right, let's go to number two pick. With number 45, Zion Young, who had one of the worst ever call-ups. I don't know if you've seen it, but DaCosta calls him, and he's very excited, clearly. And he keeps saying, yeah, let's get it. And he almost won't let DaCosta talk. And then DaCosta tries to multiple times initiate a different conversation about, you know, so who's there with you? Is your family there, kind of thing? And he's not having any of it. So it's really funny. It's worth going out there if you can see it. But really fits the Ravens' need. Every single panelist on the draft stream for us had him as the number one selection the Ravens should take as pick 45 arrived.
Wow, interesting. I mean, you'll know better than I do when it comes to the Ravens, of course, but I know that position has been a bit of a need, right? They traded for Draymond Jones in the middle of the season, mm-hmm. So they kind of tried to band-aid it a little bit. Obviously, there was the Max Crosby deal that falls through, and now they go get Trey Hendrickson. I'll tell you what I really like about the Zion Young pick is he's a high-floor run defender. I think he's ready to kind of come in and play immediately on early downs. And, you know, Trey Hendrickson's been knocked a little bit for, you know, some of the effort in the past as a run defender. So if you're going to come in and, you know, ask him to pin his ears back and rush the passer, well, you got to get to 3rd and 7, 3rd and 8, right, in order to do that. And I think guys like Zion Young are sometimes undervalued for the ability to make sure that the opposition is facing 3rd and 7, 3rd and 8. You know, 6.5 sacks, I believe it was this past year. A bit of a work in progress. I think maybe a bit of a capped ceiling as a pass rusher due to the athletic limitations that I saw on tape. But he's got really good hands, and he sets hard edges. He plays with a lot of effort. I think he's more of a technical winner as a pass rusher than he is a, you know, someone who relies on pure athleticism. But I liked this pick a lot, especially, again, for, you know, going to get Trey Hendrickson, the way they're building that defensive line room. I think Zion Young's going to do a lot of really good things for Baltimore on early downs.
We are very excited to be certain, and the Hendrickson thing is a good one. Hendrickson should play less snaps for the Ravens than he has before in the past. Obviously, the injuries are mounting up and whatnot. Zion Young is a pure rush guy. He plays against an uncovered tackle whenever he can, so the Ravens would want him on that side. But the problem is that Tavius Robinson is really also a rush end guy too. So while the fit, there's terrific fit. The rush downs you mentioned, the being able to kick inside on third down, I think is a huge advantage. And that's something that he can provide value, I think, there. But neither of them are really Sam linebackers for early down. So the Ravens have some thinking to do about how they want to deal with that, whether they want to have Tavius drop to coverage a little more. And a lot of that's important for a team like the Ravens that has a slot corner they'd like to rush from time to time. If you want to do it with zone blitz, you want to bring, you know, somebody from that same side. And the strong side is typically where obviously Kyle Hamilton is in the slot, and he can be most dangerous. So it's something you need to consider. But I love the young pick, and every panelist was thrilled with it. As an individual pick, how did you rate it?
Yeah, I thought I had a borderline first round grade on him. You know, I thought there was a couple teams near the back end, you know, the 49ers, I think the Patriots, like a couple of those teams who I thought might be in the market for an edge rusher at that spot. I would have been perfectly fine if that's the direction they went in. I had a high opinion of this player when I watched him on tape. Again, just kind of love the effort, the physicality, the tenacity that he defends the run with on early downs.
All right. Excited about it. Okay. I want to toss the next two in a hat together and talk about them together, because the Ravens double dipped at wide receiver with a third and fourth pick. Jacoby Lane in the third round, and then Elijah Surratt from the Indiana National Champions in the fourth round. Talk about those two picks in terms of what you like about them, or don't.
Interesting to me, because somewhat similar, somewhat, right? I hate to sell it short. Not, you know, every player is different, but big-bodied guys who are, you know, weapons in the red zone, attack the catch point, can kind of turn those 50-50 balls into 75-25, you might say it. Both sort of struggle with creating consistent separation. Not the most athletic guys in the world. To me, it almost felt like, and these weren't my favorite things that they did on draft weekend, in all honesty, but to me, it almost felt like hedging their bets a little bit. Like we're fairly confident we're going to get something out of at least one of these guys. And then, you know, not bringing DeAndre Hopkins back, who I believe he's still available, but doesn't look like they're bringing him back. Losing some passing down production, you know, Isaiah Likely as well. I certainly thought there was a need to kind of beef up the pass catching corps here. And I think both of those guys will do that for them. They'll be good depth. Obviously, they're projecting a pretty big step forward from Tez Walker, who had 22 yards per catch last year, and quite the efficiency from a touchdown versus receptions number, if you will. But certainly they're projecting a step for him as they ramp up his workload here. Obviously love the other two receivers, but they had to go and get some guys who I think could kind of, you know, play those number 4-5 specialized role, maybe come in the red zone, block in space. I'm sure that's something that they're going to appreciate the way
this show is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. For some, summer is their favorite season. Travel picks up, kids are out of school, and adventure is the focus. For others, juggling it all can be tough, can make you feel overwhelmed, and can make you count down the minutes until the kids are back in school. I know I look forward to summer as a time to take a break, but as a self-employed person, time spent away from my work is time I stress over wasting. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is a quality therapist who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial therapist matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right on the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session, based on 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support and therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
These two guys do, especially when you've got the run game that Baltimore has. So that's sort of how I viewed that.
Yeah, hopefully they get what they want out of those guys in terms of run blocking. That's not something that I would put the highest marks on for both of them. I don't want to get into it right now, but Jacoby Lane, I actually had lower on my board, significantly lower than Surratt. Surratt was a guy I did the wide receiver with another local analyst here from Huddle It Up Films. I'll just give him a shout out right now. He's a good one. But Elijah Surratt, I had as my number seven guy, I believe, and Jacoby Lane, I had at number 18. So, I think the Lane pick has kind of grown on me in terms of his ability to go up and get the football. I saw him at rookie camp. He certainly has some of those obvious qualities. Catch radius looks very good. But, the biggest thing about him I can say is, while he wasn't a fantastic contested catch guy, and he had 31% of his targets be contested, and he had a 49% completion rate on those catches. That's a bad combination, by the way. High contested catch rate, low contested catch percentage made. But the other component of that I don't think people talk about enough is touchdowns versus interceptions. It's just the interceptions as a percentage of throws you could look at also. 18 touchdowns, only 3 interceptions thrown his way career. And that's what you want. You want a wide receiver who, when he's not able to make the catch, can play a little defense at least too. And I think Lane gives you that. Surratt, I like for other reasons I don't want to get into, because I really want to pick your brain more about the picks.
Yeah, I actually love that, because we actually did a whole episode on our podcast too, where we looked at before the draft, like contested, catch percentage versus, I guess, converting those opportunities. And as much as Lane grays out poorly there, I do think, or did grade out poorly, I think there's a lot more that goes into that, right? Like it's a phenomenal analytical stat, but I think context, when you watch the film, what was the quarterback play like, right? Are some of those contested opportunities, sure, what was the realistic chance that he was actually going to come down with some of those balls? And if those numbers improve here, which I think they could, of course, under a quarterback like Lamar Jackson, and then keeping it simple, where they took him, if he comes in and just helps them a bunch in the red zone, is an outstanding blocker, goes up and he barely plays and he catches 4 touchdowns this year because he's just a guy they can trust in the red zone, and he blocks for Derrick Henry and he helps get him into the end zone and all of that nature, then I think we'll maybe end up looking back on that pick a little differently, maybe at least from a value perspective.
All right. Well, let's keep going here because I know we're kind of short on time. Matthew Hibner, a very odd pick, and one, a guy I had not scouted before the draft. I did enjoy watching his tape afterwards. Played at SMU and played with a quarterback that's actually very similar to Lamar Jackson and Jennings down at SMU. A guy who ran some plays through the mesh point, had other play action as a major component of the offense there. And if you look at Hibner's, a lot of his value and targets and a lot of his yak came on seam routes where he is lost behind the defense. And I question how much of that is Hibner as opposed to how much of it is really Jennings, but interesting guy.
Yeah, I think the question that I kept coming back to was, where was this guy before this season? I mean, you look at the receptions total, the receiving yardage total. If recall correctly, essentially was non-existent or close to it before this season. Was certainly a big-time breakout year for him. And he does make for an interesting case study because of it, right? And the only thing, and again, in truth, as I rated the Ravens as having the second best draft class in this 2026 iteration, was not because of this pick, right? In all honesty, where was he? That's sort of the question I kept coming back to. But you'd have to assume that the Ravens saw a guy who the arrow is kind of still pointing up on, maybe a little untapped potential that's worth exploring. And, he's probably never going to be more than a role player. I don't know that he does a lot for you as a blocker. Not sure that he's, can play in line much at all. And I don't really expect him to develop in the kind of guy who can. He's going to be a role player who, with all those weapons that they have on offense, is probably going to do something similar to what you just said. He'll occasionally get lost and make a play that'll make the highlight reel with a little bit of yak.
Well, they're moving on from a player like Charlie Kolar, who was a very well-rounded tight end, could give a little bit from a receiving perspective, gave a ton of the offense ran through him at Iowa State. But in Hibner's case, you know, he had 3 years at Michigan where he had two targets. And then he had, I think it's 24 and 35 the last 2 years at SMU. So not a lot of total career targets to go on. And he plays almost exclusively as a flex player, 22% in line. Not the kind of player that you look at and say, wow, this guy does this thing that he always does really well. And so it was a very, very surprising pick. So they must have liked athleticism. They must have liked other components about him. But it does not appear like he's going to have a huge blocking role, at least not to me.
No, I agree. I think this is very much we see like a specialized package or a specialized role for him. Like I said, he'll come in, he'll get lost a little bit behind the defense. He'll make some plays when no one's expecting him to. But you're right. I think there's obviously something that they like. I would imagine it has something to do with, you know, you kind of look at what he was able to do this past year with more opportunities. We sort of extrapolate that to a larger sample size, and we think there's more to work with here.
Okay. All right, well, let's move on and give me the high sign whenever it is you need to work with your heart out here. Chandler Rivers of Duke in the fifth round. Or did they get him in the fourth round? I'm actually round five, pick 162. A guy who a lot of people really loved. I looked at his coverage year last year and thought it really wasn't particularly good. And I'm concerned, given his height, that he's a pure slot guy, so he's not really a great fit for the Ravens. How did you grade the pick of Rivers?
Yeah, you might have to stop me on this one. I do like the player quite a bit, in all honesty. But I do think he's a slot only, a nickel only mm-hmm. player. And the way that the Ravens are set up might have a hard time, you know, getting into that lineup. As much as I like him, I think I'm smart enough that I'm not going to sit here and say, well, you know, this guy's going to play a major role this year. I think he's capable of doing so if he had landed somewhere else where maybe the fit was a bit more projectable or there wasn't as much in front of him on the depth chart. What I like about the player is there's like 4 years of starting experience. I thought he was very productive. He's athletic. He's instinctual. Did a lot of good things on tape throughout his tenure there. And, you know, yes, he's a smaller player, and that's why he's a role-specific player. But I look at some of these better slots around the NFL, and I know Kenny Moore just got cut, but, you know, Kenny Moore was a high-level player for a long time in that very role-specific – as a very role-specific player, I should say. I kind of think the ceiling is similar on Chandler Rivers, and that's a compliment. Like, I think this guy could be a very, very good nickel-only defender. Now, the fit for the Ravens, as you said, probably not great. I imagine this was a bit of a, we really like the player. Maybe it's a, you know, a best player available approach.
It certainly could be that. And the Ravens do have an availability for him to play. The job that's there for him to win is to be the slot corner on dime snaps. The Ravens play a lot of dime still, and Hamilton moves to play dime on those snaps. I imagine that will continue this year. I don't see a difference. So Rivers really needs to win that job. And then we can talk about potential outside corner opportunities. He's got the speed to play on the outside. He's just not the typical aircraft carrier the Ravens draft on the outside. They draft much bigger, longer players, hopefully with speed too on the outside. They've kind of compromised on speed with TJ Tampa last year, but two years ago now. But still not a normal pick for the Ravens. So it's a little odd to me, but hopefully it's Tavon Young and we get excited about him.
Yeah, I do think size is going to play a role here that probably kicks him inside. But I always say this to folks, like, if they needed someone to play that role potentially in dime packages, and if you got a guy in the fifth round that could do that, they don't all have to be Hall of Famers. You know, if you can get a guy in the fifth round who's going to contribute for you in a specific role, in a specific package, as you said, they still play a lot of dime, right? So if he does end up winning that job and kind of relieve Kyle Hamilton in those packages because, you know, it frees him up to go do something else, then that is a good, good pick in the fifth round, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the Ravens have a history under Ozzie of taking safeties in rounds six and seven and as UDFAs. And in fact, they drafted Dwan Landry, who was an immediate starter for them in the fifth round. They've had a long history of finding guys, and most of their sixth round and later guys just ended up being a dime back. But the dime back within the Ravens system is very important. It plays the highest leverage snaps, and they're out there, you know, 25 to 30% of the time, sometimes more in other years. And so it's been an important role. I think there's an opportunity for for Rivers to be good in that. I got two other players I want to ask you about, so you just tell me if you need to get going. Adam Randall of Clemson, reportedly the owner's pick. Kind of weird, but Bisciotti apparently did a lot of research on him, and he had somebody... This is the story that I've heard. I don't know the veracity of it, but he reportedly hired Navy SEALs to look at his character. Now, I'll tell you, the Navy SEALs, they are for hire when they're off duty. So they often will take a couple weeks off per year, and they'll be hired for corporate events and whatnot. In fact, I participated in such an event. We had Aegon University, the company I work for, and we went out on sailing with a Navy SEAL and a sailing instructor, and it was basically a leadership development program kind of thing. And they are really impressive people, I'll tell you that. But reportedly, you know, they looked into Adam Randall's background, who is a weird character, a conversion from an outside wide receiver to a running back. Kind of reminds me of Cordarrelle Patterson, maybe in that way.
I didn't know that it was an owner pick, and the whole Navy SEALs. That is fascinating. But I hope that it was some of my articles that the owner read to take this kid, because I wrote about him a lot pre-draft when I was writing, some guys who I thought were sleepers in the late rounds and things of that nature. And when I talked about lottery picks and, you kind of take a lottery ticket, this was maybe the one that I was referring to, because I was fascinated by this kid pre-draft, because as you mentioned, Ken, converts from outside wide receiver, and he ran for 800 yards this year, on what I thought was a dumpster fire of a Clemson program. No one on Clemson lived up to expectations this year. The two guys who we thought were top 10 picks, and TJ Parker and Peter Woods, they end up having bad years and they slide down the draft. They don't have a wide receiver that goes before 75th overall or whatever it was. This was a bad program this year. And this kid kind of stuck out to me as a wide receiver convert who runs for 800 yards. I was fascinated by him at the combine, and I thought he didn't get enough attention. A lot of times we've kind of gotten lost in the testing results, and we forget to weigh it maybe versus, size and profile. This kid runs a 4.5 flat at 6'3" and a half, 232 pounds. Yep. I mean, that'll check out. We're fascinated by the receivers who are 130 pounds that run 4.3. I mean, this does more for me than that does. A 4.5 flat at 232 pounds. He is a moving refrigerator.
He really looks. He's very high cut. A lot of his weight is in more or less a very well-built upper body, and he has relatively slender, I would say almost more sword-like legs. Not that that's a terrible thing, but very much looks like Derrick Henry. But the body type is just very similar. And so the other thing I think the Ravens drafted him for was they don't really have a bell cow backup to Henry. They have Justice Hill, who's more of a situational third down back, and he would never be a guy who would take a ton of carries. I don't think they want Rasheen Ali to be a guy that they would give a ton of carries to. So they needed somebody, and they got a guy at a fairly economical price who has very low career tread wear, but still has 168 carries last year. It's an exciting exacta there.
I was fascinated by it. And look, you're right. A high cut is usually an issue, right? It's not a trait you typically look for in a running back. And there are times when you watch his tape, that he runs like a guy who's still getting used to playing the position, right? In terms of, vision, instincts, the little things that come naturally to a running back who's actually been playing running back for their whole life. You can see that that's a work in progress. Now, obviously, he's landed in a spot where, they're going to give him some developmental time and opportunity. And who knows? It kind of does feel like that lottery ticket. But as much as we dogged it earlier, you know what they also say, Ken? You don't win the lottery if you don't play, right? So if that ticket's only going to cost you $1, which this essentially cost them in that, where they took him, then I was fascinated by this one. I really, really enjoyed this pickup. I'll be following his developmental path. Really can't wait to see how it goes.
Yeah, that'll be good. He's definitely one of the exciting players for camp for me as well. I'll just ask you about one more player, and that is, why did he drop so far? But Rashawn Benny is a guy I had a fourth or fifth round grade on, and he drops all the way to number 250 for the Ravens. Are you familiar with what off the field issues there are there? Or was it a combination of size and tweenerdom that people didn't like? What was the problem?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any off field, if it exists, with him. I did have a an interesting interview with him throughout this process. I mean, I came away fairly impressed with the kid. I do think that he did have a bit of a reputation, actually, I am recalling now, and I probably won't maybe fully tell the story on air, but a bit of a difficult reputation at Michigan, from what I recall. And I actually did have an interesting, sort of scenario with him, I think, back then. But interviewed him throughout this pre-draft process, and he was super interesting to me. I think the tweener aspect probably plays a role. There's also a lack of sack production. He really does not, he played a ton of years at Michigan, and there's really no sack production there. Now, they asked him to play a sort of run-first role there at Michigan, and I think he did that at a fairly decent level. There's obviously a capped ceiling here. I don't think he's ever going to turn into a dominant player. He's a back-end rotational type. Maybe he can do a little bit of the dirty work for you on first down, help you close out a game if you need him to. But, I think probably a low ceiling, but maybe a bit of a decent floor here if the attitude checks out.
His run defense was very good career. He had, as a senior, he had 4.0 stops to missed tackles was the ratio. That's kind of like an inside linebacker, particularly that's like the strikeout to walk ratio I really look for. On the defensive line, it's important, but there are other factors that can come into play. Prior to the 2025 season, he made 49 out of his first 50 college tackles. So that's remarkable. He had 11.4 stops to miss tackles for his career, which is terrific. So did have, some medical going back to high school for a knee injury, suffered in a car accident. I really liked him anyway. I was thrilled that he showed up at 250, whereas a lot of other players that our panelists seem to like, Michael Trigg, Daquan Wright, tight ends that I thought would have really added something. They were obviously blacklisted or black dotted anyway by a lot of NFL teams. They didn't get drafted.
There was certainly some off-field alleged character questions on the Baylor tight end. I know that one for sure. That's actually been out there, I think, for a little bit. But it plays a huge role, especially on day three. If character doesn't check out and the pool of prospects, there starts to be a lot less separation, right, in terms of quality. Character will often be a deciding factor.
All right, Justin, absolute pleasure having you come on and give your grades. Overall, you had the Ravens ranked second out of 32?
I did. I really like this draft class they put together. Not only did they make 11 picks, which I'll reiterate, it's not the end all be all. My worst graded team made 8 picks, and they still graded out with a D in Jacksonville. I thought Baltimore did a great job, plug and play in round one. Defensive end in round two is going to fit the scheme really, really well. Some really interesting value there on day three. Some guys I'm fascinated by, like Adam Randall. Really love Chandler Rivers as well. So I thought the Ravens did a great job. And as you noted, one of the better drafting teams of the past 30 years or so. I hope it continues and makes my grade piece look pretty smart here.
All right, Justin, thanks so much for joining us. Other folks out there, please use hashtag film study mailbag. If you have questions. But Justin, tell us where people can follow you on Twitter or where to find your work.
JustinM_NFL on Twitter. I am running NFL Draft on SI. That is Sports Illustrated's dedicated NFL Draft channel. Check us out for, as now we move forward, it's looking back on these picks, a lot of analysis. We've got day three still, steals, best value picks. Dropped my first 2027 mock. Leading up, we had 150 interviews with the prospects in this class. So I think there's some really, really unique stuff there up on NFL Draft on SI.
All right. Very good. Thanks for listening, folks. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.